Good afternoon. My name is Ann Caval, and on behalf of the Breast Cancer Education Association Board of Volunteers, I welcome you to the BCEA webinar education series. Grab a pen and paper, as there will be plenty of good information shared in the next hour. Today, we are pleased to offer the third session of a new series exploring the breast cancer experience in Minnesota communities with unequal cancer burdens. In each session of this series, we strive to help each community share its voice so that we all have a better understanding of the burden of breast cancer in their community and the unique cultural features that may be barriers or help to support women in their journey. We are grateful for the gracious contribution of our three speakers for today's webinar. Please watch for our future sessions of the Sharing Our Voices webinars. Today we have participants joining us in two ways, via webcast or by phone. For those connected via webcast, please follow along with the slideshow on your screen. Also, for those connected via the webcast, you should see a box to the left of the slides where you will be able to submit questions during the Q&A portion near the end of this session. BCEA continues to expand our mission of providing breast cancer education resources this year. This year's educational programming continues to encourage, engage, and empower those affected by breast cancer in a variety of ways, including webinars such as this one offered throughout the year. We also offer our signature education conference on October 6, 2018, at the TIES Conference Center in St. Paul, Minnesota. This conference will deliver the most up-to-date information on breast cancer treatments and nutrition, a mobile mammography unit on-site, and many roundtable discussions that connect attendees on the most pressing breast health topics. Complete conference highlights and registration are available at www.breastcancereducation.org. Early registration ends on September 21st, so be sure to register by then to save on your registration fee. We hope to see you October 6th. Please also tap into the ongoing resources on our website and social media channels available 24/7. If you are unable to attend any of our previous webinars, recordings of these sessions are available on the BCEA website under the webinar tab. This is a great way to easily access valuable information at your convenience. We also invite you to join us for a little fun and participate in one of our upcoming partner fundraisers. This weekend, come and help celebrate Baldman Brewing Company's second birthday in Eagan. They will have many fun prize giveaways of beer or swag throughout the day, including a raffle that will benefit BCEA. Also, the Shulock Breast Fest Music Festival is on September 15th in Corcoran. This is a really great opportunity to have fun, hear great music, and support a good cause. You can find more information on all upcoming events at our website, again, breastcancereducation.org. BCEA also welcomes your involvement in our organization. We welcome participation on all levels and have many different types of volunteer opportunities available, whether it's just for an hour, a year, or a couple hours a month. To see our volunteer opportunities, simply visit our website and click on the Volunteer tab. If you have not done so already, please be sure to connect with us on social media. We regularly share and foster discussion on the latest news and resources in breast cancer detection, diagnosis, treatment, and survivorship. We also encourage you to share what you learned today using the hashtag BCEAWebinar. Please be also sure to keep your eye out for information on other upcoming webinars. More webinars are planned for this year yet, and we will continue to share specific information as soon as they are available. And now I'd like to introduce the speakers for today's webinar. Julissa Rios grew up in Peru, South America, and has been living in Minnesota for the last 25 years. For the last 18 years, she has worked as a case manager at Westside Community Health Services La Clinica site, focusing on breast and cervical cancer screening, patient navigation, and linkage to care for the Latina community. Many of her patients experience multiple barriers to care, and it is her job to help them with the process, answer their questions, and provide information, education, and support. Rachel Fletcher, MPH, oversees the Community Health Program at Westside, a team of 14 staff which operates a number of public health preventative programs ranging from HIV prevention, testing, and treatment to diabetes prevention, prenatal health, family planning, and breast, cervical, and colorectal cancer screening and linkage to care. She has over 15 years' experience working in public health, including time in Quito, Ecuador, where she worked in a family planning and sexual health clinic as a health educator. In addition to work experience with breast cancer, Rachel has personal experience as a breast cancer survivor who was diagnosed at a young age. Marachaye, PA, is a family practice physician assistant at Westside Community Health Services, La Clinica. She grew up in Eau Claire, Wisconsin. She completed her undergrad degree in biology and Spanish and later studied medicine to earn her PA degree. During her undergrad, she had the opportunity to spend a year abroad in Mexico and Nicaragua. This helped develop her Spanish language skills and love for the Latino community. She currently works as primary care provider. Welcome to you all.
Thank you all very much. This is Rachel Fletcher speaking. So today we wanted to talk to you about the experience of breast cancer in the Latino community. And we have four objectives for our presentation today. First, we wanted to describe the current breast cancer burden in Minnesota's Latino communities. We wanted to discuss the unique barriers that Latinos face in prevention and detection, treatment, and survivorship. We would like to talk about some of the cultural characteristics that influence screening and also talk about some of the solutions that are culturally appropriate to increase screening. So as many of you probably know who are from Minnesota, it's a great place to live, has one of the longest life expectancies in the United States. In general, we have a high insured rate and low unemployment rates, great standards of living, amazing natural beauty, and, of course, our fantastic weather, particularly in the winter. Despite all these wonderful qualities, we do have some inequities that present themselves in our public health arena. In this webinar, we'll talk a little bit about that and how it affects the Latino community. This slide here is just to demonstrate that our heart disease deaths have decreased quite dramatically since 1980 when this chart begins. But our cancer deaths are more or less stable and only beginning to decrease slightly in the last two decades. So we're going to talk a little bit about what cancer looks like broken down into different communities. This chart shows both the incidence or the occurrence of breast cancer, the rate per 100,000 females, and also the mortality in the time period of 2008 to 2012. And what you can see by looking at this chart is that Latinas are the second highest group in terms of incidence or occurrence of breast cancers. They are the lowest mortality in this data period, but again, second highest incidence only to Caucasians. So breast cancer in Minnesota, breast cancer in females in Minnesota is the second leading cause of cancer death. In general, there is excellent survival when a person is diagnosed early, and we know that screening reduces death because you find cancer at an earlier stage, typically, when you screen earlier. And we also, you know in general that risk for breast cancer increases with exposure to estrogen, including hormone replacement therapy. Some just more general information about breast cancer. For the first time in 1996, the death rate or mortality rates from breast cancer began to drop. And in 2003, incidence of new cases, so new occurrences of breast cancer, began to drop. In general, breast cancer is the most common type of cancer in women, and it is the second leading cause of cancer deaths. The causes are really unknown, or perhaps also you could say that they're maybe complex and difficult to tease out. So early detection is the key. And we know that with mammography, we have a great tool and that we can have up to 98% survival with early detection. However, only 78% of women in Minnesota are having regular mammograms. And if we look at the diagnosis of breast cancer at a late, so diagnosis at a late stage, 50% of African Americans are being diagnosed at a late stage, 33% of American Indians, 41% of Asian Pacific Islanders, 50% of Hispanic and Latina women, and 35% of non-Hispanic white women are being diagnosed at a late stage. And among these groups, African Americans have the highest breast cancer mortality, which you can see back on the other page that we were looking at with this chart. So now I'm going to hand it over to Mara, and she's going to talk a little bit about risk of breast cancer.
Hello, everyone. Again, my name is Mara. I'm a physician assistant here at La Clinica, and I just wanted to discuss a little bit more about the medical side of breast cancer. And as we're looking at this slide right here, it shows the lifetime risk of having breast cancer. And I'm sure many of you who are listening either know someone who has had breast cancer, have had it yourself, or know someone who knows someone. It's pretty frequent in the population, and we see it quite commonly. As you can see here, the lifetime risk of having breast cancer is 1 in 8. So that means out of every 8 people you know in your life, the chances are one person may have it. Looking at someone who's age 30, we never think of young people suffering with breast cancer, but yet 1 in 2,500 have it. So look at a normal high school who may be a large high school. One in that high school can have breast cancer. So I think it's really important to keep that in mind as we're looking at screening and lifetime risk, that it actually is quite common and we really need to pay attention to that. So what are some of the risk factors to having breast cancer? Obviously, this list is not completely conclusive. For example, being female is a risk factor, but males definitely can have breast cancer as well. But some of the other ones would be getting older. And the reason for that being is actually below the getting older, the cumulative exposure to breast tissue to estrogen drastically increases your risk of getting breast cancer. So what that means is if you start menstruation at a young age or you complete menopause at an older age, your body is more exposed to estrogen over the period of your life, and that greatly increases your risk of having breast cancer. In addition, hormone replacement therapy, if you use that over 5 years, that also increases the exposure of breast tissue to estrogen. Or obesity, which your adipose tissue can convert in your body to estrogen, can also increase the breast tissue to estrogen. So all of those things play into increasing your risk factor. Also, I think many of us have heard of the BRCA genes or the genetic mutations that may lead or may have a higher increase in your risk factor to having breast cancer. So if you do have a family history of your mom or your aunt or your sister or your daughter, it may be a sign that there is some type of genetic mutation going on that's making you more likely to have it as well. So with all of that being said, as I said in the beginning of this slide, the known risk factors, being female, getting older, being exposed to estrogen, actually only account for about half of all cases. So even if you do have a high or a low risk to getting breast cancer, it definitely still is possible that you get it. This next slide is pretty interesting. It actually shows mammograms of different breasts with different breast density. And this is really important when we look at screening, because When you look at each person as an individual, some women have very fatty breast tissue, which is pretty easy to pick up on cancer. That would be in the picture more on the left. You can see that there's not a lot of interference. You can pick out pretty easily where there may be cancer. On the far right, that shows a person who may have much more dense tissue in her breast. And when you do a standard mammogram on that lady, it's a lot harder to see what may be normal breast tissue and what may be actual cancer. So it's harder to pick that out. So in this next slide here, it talks a little bit more about breast density and how we address that in the clinic. In 2014, Minnesota passed legislation that mammogram results reports would include information on breast density. So that means that when we're doing these mammograms, we have to look and see how dense is the tissue and does that show if the mammogram was actually a good indicator of screening for breast cancer or not. Breast density is associated with an increased risk of breast cancer, and it, like I said before, it does make imaging more difficult. So we continue research in the community to look at density versus risk, and there are additional screening options that we have available that I personally think are very important, especially for women who do have denser tissue. A lot of people know of the quote-unquote 3D mammogram, which gets a better picture of what the breast may look like. MRI is actually an excellent source for screening for breast dense tissues, too. I think the reason that we don't do that as often is just because of cost. MRIs are extremely expensive, even though they are very accurate as well. The other thing that is a little bit more accessible, and I personally use a lot in my practice, would be ultrasound technology. We're able to use that if we think we see something on a mammogram, we can confirm with ultrasound if that's actually a tissue that may be cancerous or may not. So it's a little bit difficult because there's no real consensus or established recommendation, so it's something that each individual patient has to discuss with their provider. So this slide here, again, talks a little bit about having mammograms for women aged 50 to 74 in the last 4 years. It breaks it down into two different groups, one based on race and one based on ethnicity. As you can see in race, the percentage of women that have had a mammogram in the last 2 years is actually pretty high in the African American population and the white population, but in American Indian or Alaska Native and Asian populations, it's a little bit lower. When you break that chart down into ethnicity, which is more what we're focusing on in our talk today, when you look at the non-Hispanic population, you can see that that number is a lot higher, but when you break it down into the Hispanic Latino population, that number drops down quite a bit. So there is a gap in the amount of Latinos that have reported having a mammogram in the last 2 years. This graph goes on to show about breast cancer survival. And I think the important thing to pick out on this graph here is when you're looking at localized versus regional versus distant, localized is people survive 5-year survival 90% of the time. And most of the time, the localized cases are caught in mammography if we do the yearly or bi-yearly screening. By the time the breast cancer has spread to more distant places, if it's spread to the lymph nodes or the esophagus or the lungs, that means that somebody probably hasn't had screening quite as recently, and the 5-year survival drastically decreases. So the topic of discussion is when do we screen, which is a little bit of a tricky and ambiguous topic. There are many different organizations out there looking at when we should be doing this, and there isn't exact consensus on that. In 1996, there was a consensus conference, and then in the 2002 and 2013, there were the Cochrane reports. In 2009, there was the USPSTF Balancing Risk and Benefit Report. And again, the bottom line is we have all of these different agencies, all of these different organizations, and we don't have a consensus on that. What we really, really urge people to do, though, is discuss this with your provider, make an informed decision, make sure that you talk about your risk versus benefit and personal preference on when to screen and when that should be done. So talking about this, this is a basic breakdown of guidelines. Again, the most important thing that we're looking at is breast self-awareness, to know your normal, know what is healthy for you, be checking yourself, know that when you feel something that may not be right or something feels off, that you go in and don't be afraid or ashamed to ask your provider about that. As basic guidelines, what we look at in clinic, from ages 40 to 44, you can choose to do it yearly or every other year. Ages 45 to 54 are probably the most critical years that you are having yearly mammography screening. Ages 55 and older, you can choose yearly. You should be doing it at least every 2 years, but really no harm done in doing it yearly. And then if your life expectancy is at least 10 years, so say you're 80 years old, out hiking 10 miles a day and very healthy, and you know you're going to live another 10 years, keep doing the screening. Age should not prevent you from doing that.
Great. Thank you, Mara. Now we're going to hand the conversation over to Julissa, who's going to talk a little bit about factors that influence mammography use.
Hi, everybody. I will talk about factors and race, ethnicity, age, income, education level, and access to medical care. For Latinos, Hispanic, the access to medical care, it's a really important topic to talk about it because not a lot of people had access to medical care. In different populations, Latino women were least likely to have had a mammogram in the last 2 years. Hispanic ethnicity as a proxy measure for being uninsured. In Minnesota, approximately 75% of Minnesota women, 40 and older, reported a mammogram in the last 2 years, with a rural metro variation of 17%. Increasing of screening mammography to 81% in the U.S. population has been identified as a healthy people 2020 objective. Barriers to screening. Inadequate access and ability to lack of insurance, costs, socioeconomic issues, poverty, homeless. A lot of people, prefer to bring food to the table. They go to the doctor and pay for a mammogram. Competitive survival priorities, mistrust of healthcare system, fear of diagnosis and no money for treatment, cultural belief and practice, logistics, scheduling, time of work, childcare, transportation, no interpreters available.
Julissa, do you want to talk a little bit about any of those particular barriers and why they're really relevant to your patients?
Yes. Here we see it's a daily basis. Everyday cases, the people, they don't have transportation, they don't drive, they don't know how to get to the appointment, and because of that, they just call and cancel the appointment, and many times don't even call and cancel, they just don't show to their appointment. They are scared to get fired from work, and they don't want to miss, the time from work, and they just decide between the money they're going to earn for that day and the mammogram, they just decide to put the mammogram away and just go back to work because it's so hard to find jobs and provide for the family. It's so important that they just don't decide to go to the appointment. Another thing is, I can see I'm talking about my culture, about Latinas. Usually Latina moms and Latina women, they just take care of everybody in the family, and the last person they go to the appointment, so they will do it that's for themselves. They take care of the husband, they take care of the kids, grandkids, daughter-in-law, everybody, but when it's time for them to go to their appointment, so take time for them, they just keep putting it away and decide, next time, I will do it next week. And that next week never comes. Mm-hmm. That's something that happens all the time. We see it here. They bring everybody in the family, but
But themselves.
But themselves.
And I would just like to add one other thing onto that that I see in my clinical practice all of the time, is that many women don't know that here, at least in the state of Minnesota, we have wonderful programs to help pay for the cost of screening. And a lot of times I'll have a patient come in, and I'll say, okay, you're due for your mammogram, and she'll say, oh no, doctor, I can't do that. I can't afford my mammogram. I can't afford to do that. And to see the look on people's faces when I'm able to say, oh, we actually have screening provided that we can do for free, and they just light up and say, wait, really? This is a resource that we have? And so I think one of the barriers is that people just don't have the education that there are resources out there to get this screening done.
They assume they're going to the hospital. It's really expensive.
Yes, exactly.
I'm not going to be going. No, don't send me to the hospital. The hospital is really, really expensive. I'm not gonna be able to pay for that.
Mm-hmm.
And this is one of the biggest barriers. Another thing is, everybody speaks English. I'm not going to understand what they say to me. Yes.
Yes. All right. I'm going to move to the next slide.
Addressing barriers. I think in our conversation, we address a lot of barriers, but barriers have changed over time. Lack of knowledge or lack of physicians, they can talk and explain what's going on, mm-hmm. and how we have these wonderful programs that are available for the community. The meaning of health and wellness. Who makes the health decision? Access and cost of service. Addressed by using evidence-based strategies and bringing free or low-cost service directed to the community, community partnership. And when you say direct to the community, here in our website on community health services, we have the mobile mammography unit. It seems like it's been, every single year we have more people coming to these events, more people screening. Last time, in each site, we screened more than 50 people for events.
In the course of an 8-hour day.
Yes.
So
in one day, which means a lot to the community. And now a lot of people are aware of this event and call and try to schedule and come to have a mammogram during this event, providing an excellent service. And I cannot express how happy I am to see how many people come during that day just to have a mammogram and get educated and have, receive this care they need. Reaching Latina women. Breast cancer, most common cancer in Latina women and leading cause of death. Latina women were least likely to have had a mammogram in the last 2 years. 50% of Latina women in Minnesota are present with late stage diagnosis. Barrier, again, the same barrier, cause, lack of insurance, language, and logistics. Who make the healthcare decisions and the family?
Julissa, can you talk a little bit more about why Latinas and other women of color are diagnosed at later stages than white women?
For the same reason, I think education plays a big role. Usually, they're going to take care of themselves probably in later age, one, due to money. Another thing is when nobody home, the kids grow up, they don't have to go to school, they don't have to pay medical bill for the family, they probably will decide, now it's time for me to go to the doctor. Many times because they don't feel they are sick, they decide, I'm healthy, I don't have any symptoms, I don't want to go to the doctor and get a bill for, I don't feel sick, I'm okay.
Mm-hmm.
Many times say, I was fine. When I went to the doctor, I came home and got sick. That's another thing, just I prefer to be like, I don't feel anything, I don't need to go to the doctor.
Right. And one of the things that Mara mentioned and she could talk about again is just, the later a person gets screened, the more, the later they are in their life, the more likely they are to have had increased exposure to estrogen, which increases their risk of cancer. So,
yeah, I can comment on that a little bit more. I think every unique situation is a little bit different, but I see quite often in our communities, I'll have ladies come in 50, 60 years old, recently immigrated to the United States and have never had a mammogram before, have never had a pap smear done before, and they simply have not had the access to those services before in their life. So that's definitely one barrier, especially for new immigrants to the country. I think the fear of the unknown, the fear of, okay, what happens if I am diagnosed? What does treatment mean? How much is that going to cost? Am I going to be able to provide for my family? And so I think that there's a lot of times I'll have a patient come in that's had a breast lump for maybe a year, and she was so afraid to come into clinic to have it checked out because she didn't know what that means.
Right. And we are incredibly lucky at our organization to have a fully funded position of a case manager, which is Dulisa, to help navigate that process for patients. And for anyone in other healthcare organizations who's looking for, you know, a best practice, we would recommend trying to have a patient navigator or a case manager who is dedicated solely to this process of helping the women in whatever your target population is get screened and navigate through the care process. Because, Dulisa, talk a little bit about what that looks like for you to work from the beginning, maybe a person who hasn't been screened but they have a breast lump, now they get screened, they have a diagnosis. What does it look like for you after that?
It's difficult to explain in just, you know, half an hour or an hour what goes through a person who's just been diagnosed, does not speak the language, all the information, all the material that she receives are in English. And when you just get this information through the voice and interpret is twice as hard because you don't know if you're listening to the interpreter, you're looking to the doctor, what exactly is going on, what the doctor is saying, what the interpreter is repeating to you, and how you're going to put all these pieces together when you don't have insurance, you don't speak the language, you don't have money, and you have three or four kids at home that you need support. You know, all these pieces together is like overwhelming. For many as a Latina, when somebody tells you in your country that you have cancer, it's a sentence of death. That means you're going to die. That's pretty much no hope. You know, in our country, the mortality rate are really, really high when you have cancer. There are only a few percent of people that survive due to, you know, they cannot afford treatment. When they come here and they don't have the insurance, they believe they're going to die.
And I just want to jump into that. If we remember back to that five-year survival rate, for localized breast cancer, for five-year survival, 97% of people are able to survive if the breast cancer is caught early. So there is this fear, like you're talking, Jaleesa, that people come in and the cancer is a death sentence maybe in their home country. And I think they don't understand that here we actually have wonderful treatment if we can catch it early.
Yes, and like I say, the patients come here and they meet with me and they say, can you please repeat everything what the doctor say? And many times I ask, there was the interpreter present. Yes, but I don't know what they said. What do I have? How are we going to do this? And this is where the process starts. I have to help them first to understand what the doctor was trying to explain, appointments, what is going to happen, what test, what is an MRI, what is a CT, what the doctor is ordering this, trying to put in a calendar for a lot of people to make sure they can have a visual understanding that from now on they're going to have a lot of appointments coming up. They're not going to be able to go to work the same way they were used to go before because now they have to commit the time to go to the hospital. I have to explain all this, and I have to try to arrange transportation, arrange all these appointments, have the insurance, have the papers done for them to go and have the service they need, call the cancer center, explain all this to them, and try to educate them when this new patient and see how else I can do for the patient. You know, try to provide information in Spanish, try to be accessible to these patients on the phone or when whatever they need me, trying to explain step by step what's going on and what it's going to be, if they need treatment, if they need chemo, if they need surgery, the downtime, a scarf, they're going to happen in the body after that. They are like, you know, mastectomy, usually Latino women, they don't qualify more than high risk. They don't qualify for prostheses, you know, like reconstruction, I mean. And all this I have to explain and try to break down to them in, you know, the most kind way possible.
So, Julissa, you just mentioned something really important that I bet is probably new information to a lot of people, which is that for some of your patients, they don't qualify for reconstruction. Can you explain why that is and how that relates to their immigration status and insurance?
Due to the immigration status, many of the patients that come here in our clinic, they don't qualify for reconstruction because reconstruction is elective surgery. And EMA or the insurance they qualify only covers emergency. The surgery is an emergency. The cancer treatment is an emergency. Chemo, radiation, the treatment is an emergency. But even though it's really important to the self-esteem, to the, you know, everything emotional for them to have the reconstruction does not qualify as an important treatment, as an emergency treatment. It's an elective and it's not covered.
So that can be pretty harsh information and news to give a client, to give a patient.
Especially when they are like 36 years old, they're young.
Mm-hmm.
They have to go through this and now they're gonna, you know, look different.
Mm-hmm.
Even though a lot of people say, oh, at least I'm alive,
mm-hmm.
you know, makes a lot of difference.
Yes, the meaning of elective becomes very arbitrary in that situation.
Yes.
So thank you, Julissa and Mara. I'm going to move this slide forward here to just note here that Hispanic and Latina people are the largest, is the group where we're seeing the largest amount of population growth in Minnesota, and we expect to be the largest population of people of color in the state by 2030. I also wanted to talk a little bit about what our organization has done to increase screening for Latina women and just kind of tie together all the different things that Julissa and Mara have talked about before we open up for questions eventually. So as I mentioned before, we have a fully funded SAGE case manager position, and the SAGE program, if you're not familiar with it, is through the Minnesota Department of Health. It is a federal program, however, so if you're listening to this call and you don't live in the state of Minnesota, but you live somewhere in the United States, it should be something that you have access to. The SAGE program is a screening-oriented program that provides screening for mammograms, for cervical cancer, and also for colorectal cancer in some places. And so they provide screening for people, you know, who have not had screening before or have. And then they also can do diagnostic work for people who have abnormal results on their screening. So we have Julissa here who works, you know, with patients to get them through that entire process. And the case management part of her name really refers to what happens when she has a patient who is diagnosed with breast cancer at some point along the way and then needs to access treatment. And Julissa mentioned a lot of that, and I'll touch back on that again at a later point. But some of the other pieces that are really critical are, you know, as Julissa and Mara have mentioned, people don't necessarily have access to transportation to go from one place to another to get screening. They maybe don't have child care. It's really difficult for them to take time off work for more than one appointment, so bundling services is really critical. So to address that issue, because we don't have mammography machines as part of our clinics, we have a partnership with Park Nicollet, and we work with them in their mobile mammography van, and we put on several events every year. So if you're in a place at an organization that is looking for ways to increase accessibility to screening, we would highly recommend that you try to look at the health organizations that are in your state or in your area and see if they have something similar to a mobile mammography van where they could come and partner with you. The way that it works is pretty straightforward. The van comes and it has the equipment that's needed for doing mammograms, only screening, not diagnostic. And our clinic, our team works together to schedule as many appointments in advance as we can, and then we have a separate process for doing walk-ins on the day of. But this gives our clients access to screening at our facility through partnership, and it's a place that they're already familiar with. They're familiar with the staff. They feel comfortable. There are usually enough staff around that if they have to bring their kid, somebody could watch them for 10 minutes while they go in the van. And so it makes it a lot easier for multiple patients to get screened all at one time. Whereas scheduling 50 mammograms, you know, outside of a mobile mammography event might take almost a month to complete that many mammograms based on our availability with other organizations. Another thing that Julissa has not yet mentioned is her cancer support group that she runs that I would say is an incredible part of the services that we provide that also increases screening, and maybe not intentionally but indirectly, because Julissa has run this support group for almost 12 years, and it started out as a breast cancer-specific support group and has morphed into a
cancer.
All cancer support group, and I'd say that people come to that group and they are aware of, you know, they're aware of the support they can get. They have some educational opportunities with Julissa to find out about what treatment looks like or what resources are available, and then through that word of mouth, they're sharing with their community, you know, things that can reduce the fear that comes along with the diagnosis, or things that can reduce the uncertainty and the perhaps just the beliefs that get in the way of someone taking care of themselves and doing the screening they need to do. So, Julissa, could you talk a little bit more about your breast cancer or your cancer support group?
Cancer support group. I meet with the ladies for the last, in October it's going to be 12 years. Like Rachel said, it started as a breast cancer support group, but after I went to the radio, I remember, and I called and I said I was inviting all the people that have breast cancer to come to the clinic, and we're just going to get together and see what was coming. I didn't have no experience how to do this. I only noticed there was no cancer Spanish support group in whole Minnesota in Spanish. And I got a couple phone calls from people. They called me and said, oh, I have liver cancer, can I come? And I have kidney cancer, can I come? And I realized that, whoa, it's not the need for breast cancer patient, it's a need for cancer patient in general. I went back to the radio and I asked for another 5 minutes free to talk to the community, and they said, oh, forget about it, it's not a breast cancer. If you have cancer, come and meet with me this day, this afternoon. I can tell you that I didn't have a budget to provide nothing to the patients. There was $0, just only my friends and my husband supporting me. That's how that started. And now 12 years later, I think I will never stop the cancer support group. Everybody comes, everybody knows that we meet here. I have people that have been in the cancer support group for many years, and I have a lot of people that sadly are not longer in the cancer support group. I try to provide education, support. I try to provide understanding. I bring people from the community that can talk about nutrition, can talk about side effect, can talk about, like, next month I'm going to have people that will come and talk about immigration issues. She's a lawyer. She's going to come and bring and try to give a little bit of peace, because dealing with cancer and having the fear to be deported is not a good thing. I'm trying to support that and trying to tell them that everything is going to be okay, even though in my heart I don't know if it's going to be okay with the immigration,
right?
How hard it is. You know, I try to read letters from the county they receive. I try to make sure they went to their appointments. I have wigs, I have hats, I have bras, prosthesis. I even have underwear, senior diapers. I have safety kits that I call, because sometimes people donate food, but people forget about towels, sanitary towels, toothbrush, toothpaste, soap, lotions. I have everything here. you name it, I have it. All this, and we get together and we talk, we laugh. We talk really loud because we are Latinos. We eat food and sometimes we cry. But we are together, at least with the years I learned a lot about how can I show support to this Latino community. And I hope I can keep doing that.
And we hope so, too.
Yeah.
One other comment I wanted to make before we open the floor up to questions is around that piece of insurance, immigration status, and treatment navigation. So in Minnesota, we have a program called MABC, which stands for Medical Assistance Breast and Cervical, and that is essentially medical assistance that a person can receive if you are undocumented and you have a breast cancer diagnosis or a cervical cancer diagnosis. You can receive 2 months of presumptive eligibility through MABC. However, you will not be able to get the full year, which a person who is documented would receive. So we have to have a very strong partnership with the agencies that we refer to for diagnosis and treatment, so that we make sure we are navigating the process of applying for MABC and the subsequent insurance, which is emergency medical assistance that Julissa was referring to, so that our patients can access care without an interruption in care. We've had situations where a patient, you know, it's not for anybody wanting to create an interruption of care. It's that there's a lot of bureaucracy and paperwork required to initiate and maintain these services. And it can happen quite easily because of how much time it takes for them to happen, that a person may have gotten presumptive eligibility and started some cancer treatment, but then hasn't had their emergency medical assistance approved and has to stop. So we try to avoid that at all costs. But this is one of the barriers that we face as you know, healthcare providers who are providing services to people who are not being granted full insurance by our country. So with that, I'm going to stop talking and open the floor for questions.
Well, thank you all for so much great information. We do have a few questions. The first of which is, Latino women are not a homogenous group, so country of origin or cultural variation. Can you comment about how you may need to adapt strategies to educate and screen, and what has been your experience in that?
When we say Latinos and Hispanic, many times people assume that's people from Mexico. That's kind of, you know, and because they speak Spanish, we are all the same. We speak Spanish, but due to the different regions we were born, we use different words, we address things different, and we have different beliefs. We can understand really well each other, even though there are some words for me that will make different sense, different somebody from El Salvador, but we can understand. But addressing all that, it's difficult. With the years, you, like me, I learned how to be, I can say it, appropriate to use or refer to some words they can use and they can mean the same to everybody,
mm-hmm.
or means everybody. If they don't understand some people, I cannot try to use two or three different words to express the same thing. But it's different. Even though we speak Spanish many times, doesn't mean we can understand each other fully. It's mm-hmm. It's a process of learning. But when you say whatever you say, when you smile, that makes a lot of difference.
It also probably depends on where a person is and how long they've been in this country. If they're a new immigrant or if they're a second or third generation Latina who's lived here for a long time, their experience is going to be different.
It's going to be different. And it's, you know, and sometimes, like I can talk to my own experience with my kids, sometimes they speak three words in Spanish and one in English. You know, they mix that, the newer generations, even though we call them, oh, you're bilingual. No, because when they speak, they mix one word in English. You know, that's kind of, you have to understand that too.
In my clinical practice, when I'm seeing patients, whether it's for breast cancer screening or really any other preventative care, when I have new patients, one of my first questions to my patients is always, what country are you from? How long have you lived here in the United States? Tell me about your hometown, because it really gives me an idea of who this person is, where they're coming from, what their cultural beliefs may be in a short 15-second period. Obviously, none of us are experts in the intricacies of every single culture group in Latin America, but I think really just learning how to listen to our patients, understand where they're coming from, and guide them through the medical maze that we have here in the United States with their cultural understanding is really, really important, no matter where they're from.
Well, thank you. All that was great. What a great answer. So you talked a lot about screening. You talked about the importance of or the detriment of late screening. You've talked about the barriers to screening. So one question that came through is, what can you do to promote early screening for Latina women?
I can speak to that briefly. One of the things that our program staff in our breast cancer prevention and screening programs have done is have worked to create systems to identify when a person is ready to be screened. And so we use our electronic medical record to as a source of information based on a person's age. And then we have data analysts who prepare reports that we can run. And so we know when someone is about to turn 40. And we use these lists to do outreach, and we do that outreach in a variety of ways. We have one person who's not with us today on this webinar, but who also does similar work, and she sends out birthday card, you know, happy 40th birthday, time to get a mammogram card. And those have varying success for people depending on how mobile they are in their lives. A lot of people are, you know, moving a lot and they may be not at the same address, and so, or they don't really care about their mail. But that idea of, you know, starting to look to when a person is about to become eligible for screening is one tool we use. And we use that same list to generate appointments for our mobile mammography events. So we know, you know, we have a list of all of our patients who are going to be eligible, and we can sort it by age, and we target those, the people who have never been screened before. And so some of those are older people than 40, but we target the 40-year-olds as well to get them to come to those screening events.
Well, that's a great idea. We all need those reminders.
Yeah.
And to kind of piggyback off of that, one other thing that we do here at the clinic that I just love is many of us providers will have a clinic once or twice a month where it'll be pure women's health, including breast cancer screening. And Julissa is wonderful. She'll call each of the patients before the appointment, remind them to come, and then we can get them their mammogram appointment that same day. She'll get a lot of the paperwork filled out before the patient even comes to the clinic, so things just run really smoothly. And I have a very, very, very low no-show rate for those clinics because of the personal touch of reaching out to those patients individually. So I think that's a huge way to get this early screening, is just to reach out to them and to let them know we care.
Yep, making it personal and easy.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
We had that planning too. Usually here too, also we have the MAs that work like with Mara and other providers, the day before they look the schedule. If they see anybody that's turning 40 or just turned 40 and never had a mammogram, they put an alert note for the provider, they put it in my schedule, talk to the patient, and they help us to get the people they just walk for, like I said, a flu, to talk about the mammogram, schedule an appointment, and just get her with a new appointment for a physical, a breast exam, and a mammogram.
Yeah, that's a great point, because sometimes, you know, the reports that we run from our medical records are relying on existing patients that we have. And so if we have new patients that come into the system after we've run that report, we don't run that report every day. We run that report, you know, about monthly or sometimes even quarterly. So there's new people that get added all the time, so that kind of cross-functional dedication to seeing who's up for screening between the medical assistant and the provider and Julissa as our case manager, it really helps to get the job done.
Well, those are all excellent, and you kind of touched upon this too, but I'm wondering if you can expand upon it a little bit more and talk about what other resources exist for Latinas once they have been diagnosed with cancer.
So, yeah, that's a great question. The general answer is that the resources are limited, but the other more complex answer is that, as I mentioned before, there is the MABC, 2 months of presumptive eligibility for treatment, and then there's emergency medical assistance. So our recommendation would be that when a person is diagnosed, they, you know, if they live in Minnesota and live anywhere near us, please come to us, we'll help you. But if not, you would want your patients to know about those two resources and to be able to connect with someone who is designated as a person who can assess them for those and then get them onto that. Julissa, what do you want to add?
Yes, because when you apply for EMA, there will be the emergency medical assistance. The EMA needs to have somebody dedicated from the hospital to write a care plan for that patient, because whatever the doctor order has to be pre-approved from the county to get paid. There are some medication and some treatment that the county will not approve, and they have to be denied to the patient. That's where it's so important that a social worker or somebody from the hospital writes a care plan with the EMA application. After the EMA application it's approved, we need a care plan in order for the treatment to start and get all the services the patient needs. And there's a list of medication and treatment with each county that the county will pay for the patient. Not all treatment and not all medication are paid under EMA also.
So EMA is administered by in Minnesota, it's administered by each county.
Yes.
And so they're the people who process the application. The money comes through the Department of Human Services, but it is administered at the county level. Other than those resources, which really are just for the, you know, the medical side of things, here we have the support group, which we've already mentioned. We take an integrative approach to care at our clinic. So if, you know, a person cannot get cancer treatment through our organization, but we are providing other care that they need for primary care and some of the other ancillary services they might need.
Yes.
Yeah. So any other questions?
That's all we have for now. We're coming to the close of our webinar. We thank you so much, Rachel, Julissa, and Mara, for this invaluable information that is just so too hard to find, and so we appreciate you to help spreading the word about this information. We also thank all the participants for joining us today. Please share what you learned today via our social media channels, and please join us on October 6th at our annual conference and future webinars. Thank you very much, everyone.
Thank you.
Thank you.